the act of betrayal by Judas took place in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's a garden worth thinking about a little bit. There are two great gardens in the Bible. They are the Garden of Gethsemane and the Garden of Eden. And they form, as it were, bookends in the drama of redemption. Because the first Eden saw the first Adam fail the test of obedience. And that made redemption necessary. The second Adam, in the second garden, passed the test of obedience. And that made redemption sure. That accomplished redemption. The one created the need, the other led to the deed. The two great gardens. In the garden, Jesus didn't just say yes to the test. He said yes to perhaps the most difficult test imaginable. It's one way of getting at the question of why these strange events in the Garden of Gethsemane take place at all. That is to say, Jesus says he is overwhelmed with sorrow. And although he often spoke about his impending death, he says here in verse 39, "My Father, if it is possible, maybe may this cup be taken from me." Now, why the sudden vacillation? Why the agony? It's only coming time for Jesus to do what he always said he would do. And so people ask questions about this, and maybe even people ask in confusion, is this inconsistent? Where did Jesus' knowledge, his divine knowledge, go? Why is he in such agony? Is he afraid of the pain of crucifixion? Is he afraid of death itself? And some people, I've even read this, have said, you know, it seems odd that Christian martyrs actually surpass Jesus because they died singing and they died testifying, and Jesus here is in sorrow, great sorrow. Why? Well, I think we certainly want to say that as a real man, he would have had a genuine revulsion at the physical agony of crucifixion. No need to deny that. It's a terrible way to die. And even if you know it's coming, it's necessary, much, much more than the most painful surgery that you can imagine, it still makes you apprehensive when the hour comes. That, I think that's true. I don't think that's all there is to it. I think it's also true that Jesus knew that his death would be unique. The language we've talked about before, "Take this cup from me, may this cup be taken from me," comes from the Old Testament. Places like Jeremiah 25 and Isaiah 51 use the language of the cup to suggest God's wrath poured out. Again, I think we talked about it before, the image of draining to the dregs the cup of God's wrath, which makes men reel and stagger drunk, vomit and fall down in it. And not simply because it makes them drunk, and drunkenness is not viewed as something to be sought, but as misery in the Bible, but also because it's drained to the dregs, to the bitter last. It has to be drunk. Now, what is the cup? The cup is, of course, the cup of God's wrath towards sin. What Jesus dreads is bearing sin and the consequences of sin. And maybe even in that two parts, it says in 2 Corinthians that him who knew no sin was made to be sin on our behalf. Which means, in a way that I don't know how we could ever fathom, Jesus became sin. So that all the, what? The hatred, the lies, the deceit, the lusts, the thievery, the malice, the boasting, the gossip, on and on we could go. It was all laid upon him. And he knew it, and he bore it. And he bore the wrath for it. He both became sin, and he bore the wrath for sin. Furthermore, as we'll see later, and I won't go into it now, he did it at the price of separation from the Father. And we'll see that a little bit later tonight. And so I think we can say, as a human being, he feared the cross, but there is much more to it than that. Let me pause for a question, if anybody has one, about the Passover night, Passover and the teachings in Gethsemane and at the Passover meal. Yes, Greg? The question is, how do we account for the fact that Jesus says this is his body broken, when in fact we read prophecy, and then in fact not one of his bones will be broken? You know, we could go a literalistic direction and say, well, it says none of his bones will be broken, but the body is broken in the crucifixion. And I actually decided not to go into the gruesome details in class tonight. They're available, and some of your readings go into that somewhat. But various bones would come out of joint. Actually, that's another thing prophesied. Not broken, but the process of hanging the cross could pull the shoulder out of its socket, for example. Now, that's a kind of breaking. And certainly the most common mode of crucifixion. Crucifixion was considered too gruesome to be described in antiquity. So we don't really know everything about it, because nobody would write it down. It was considered impolite. Impolite at best. That's a mild word for it. It was considered unutterable. And so people knew it, and it wasn't described. But at least some of the ways, apparently there were multiple ways of being crucified, but most of the ways would involve death from slow filling of the lungs with water as the person's tissue simply broke down as they were hanging suspended. I mean, just slowly everything inside just, you know, tears up and breaks down. So a body broken. So you could go at it a literalistic way, or you could go at it just a global way. Well, his bones weren't broken, but his body was. He was killed. And, you know, to simply say, look, the language is metaphorical and approximate, and we understand what it's saying. Yeah. What does it mean that Christ became sin? I don't know if anybody can fully elaborate on that. I do know that he bore in his body the consequences of our sin. And we'll at least say, the question was, can I say more about it? Oh, I'll say a little more about it and see if a little bit later and see if that satisfies. There is more to be said, especially when we come to Jesus' words on the cross. Well, let's look at the actual arrest and trial first, and then we'll come to the crucifixion later. Again, we could pause and ask, how did this actually happen? How did these things come to pass? We know that the Jewish leaders believed that Jesus deserved to die. We also know that the crowds could turn on Jesus, because they never really understood what he was driving at. They could turn on him because they'd never really committed to him. Right? Third, the disciples can fall away because they never really adopted Jesus' viewpoint with regard to his death and resurrection. Never understood what he was driving at. And fourth, the fact that this is predicted over and over suggests that ultimately it is God who is in control. Humanly speaking, we can explain it. And then from the standpoint of the divine decree and plan, we can explain it as well. The trick with regard, if that's the word, the task with regard to the crucifixion of Christ is to enter into it, not just from the outside, not just to stand off judging, and to stand off and condemn Pilate and condemn the Jewish leaders, and have an exercise in condemning others. The trick is to enter. Now, I just want to use a little analogy with you. Have you ever been in a conversation that you couldn't quite penetrate? You know, you're at dinner at somebody's house, and they just keep talking about things that you don't know anything about. Well, I remember one day, one meal in 1 hour, and, you know, I'm capable of talking. I just couldn't. I had nothing to say. For a half an hour, they talked about cooking with herbs. For me, salt is an herb. That's about as close as it gets, you know. Maybe peppers. Pepper and herb, I don't know. Maybe cooking with herb is cooking with people named Herbert, but you're in England and they don't pronounce the H. So, cooking with herbs. And then after that, they started talking about the effect of diverse distillation methods on the smoothness of whiskey. And see, I didn't know anything about that either. I'm just waiting. How can I get into this? And, you know, it's possible to feel very much like an outsider when you look at the gospel accounts. And just to sit there and say, look how stupid and vain and venial and foolish and so forth the Jewish authorities and Pilate is, and just to stand outside and condemn and never enter. What we need to do is enter into this as well as evaluate it. Okay. We begin with Jesus' arrest. It was actually set in motion by events described in John chapter 11, 47 and 57. In 11, 47 through 57, just after the resurrection of Nazareth, we read in 45 and 46 that many Jews saw what Jesus did, put their faith in him. Others went to the Pharisees, told them what Jesus had done. And the chief priests and Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin, a good translation. We'll say Sanhedrin. That's the Supreme Council of the Jews. They talked for a while. They expressed their concerns. He's performed many signs, verse 47. If he continues this way, everybody will believe in him. That's their envy. If that happens, the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Now, I've said that their concern is partly envy. But the statement, our place, does not mean our place of authority. The term there, in the original, the place, is a technical term for the temple. And just as Jews didn't like to say the name of God because of fear of blasphemy, so also they did not like to say, some of them at least, didn't want to say the temple. They simply, or the house of God. They just, because, you know, house of God, then you have to say God. They called it the place. So their fear is that the Romans will take away the place and our nation. That is, along with their concern about faith and envy, they also foresee disaster. They think it's very possible that the mobs may follow Jesus, and the result is that everybody's going to suffer mightily. So a blend of maybe a few altruistic thoughts along with their selfish thoughts. The high priest, Caiaphas, speaks up. He says, in the original language, this maybe gives a clue as to what kind of a man he is. His literal words in the Greek are, "You don't know nothing." It's kind of a rough, rude man. "You don't know nothing. You don't even know that it is better for one man to die for the people than that the whole nation perish." Now, of course, as high priest, as John points out, he is telling the truth. He doesn't know it. And that's called irony. When somebody says one thing, but it means something else, and they don't know it. Or, possibly, when somebody says something that means something else, and the audience doesn't know it. But when the surface meaning clashes with the deep meaning, that's called irony. And there's a lot of irony from here on in. So that we get the picture that the Jews, that the truth was right there. If they just understood even their own words, they would have seen it. And it's so clearly labeled here at the start to clue us in to look for this. As high priest, Jesus told the truth. He prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. Again, if if the Gospels are accused of anti-Semitism, here's our answer, that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation and also for the scattered children of God. From that day on, they plotted, they resolved to kill Jesus. The decision has been made at this point. It's settled. They're going to kill him. Judas' betrayal, one more time, supplies the mechanism. He seizes Jesus, or helps some others seize Jesus quietly in Gethsemane. He leads a contingent. Let's just stay in Rome, in John for a minute, to chapter 18. He leads a contingent of temple guards and Roman guards to the spot in Gethsemane, 18:2. Jesus, as we read elsewhere, rouses his sleepy disciples who are unable to watch with him in Gethsemane, just in time for them to see Judas come, kiss Jesus, and then the kiss identifies him and he is taken. Peter briefly resists, whips out a sword, chops off somebody's ear. Jesus says, listen, if sword play was going to solve things, I could bring down legions of angels. Put it back, and he puts the ear back. In John, we get a perspective, a series of perspectives on Jesus' arrest. We need to take careful observe carefully, let me put it that way. Jesus shows himself, above all, to be the master of this situation. Notice, when the soldiers arrive, 18:3-4, Jesus comes out to greet them. He went out, verse 4 says, and asked them, who is it that you want? Answer, Jesus of Nazareth, or Jesus the Nazarene. Verse 5, I am he, Jesus said. Now, this is one of those times when I wish you all knew Greek. Because in the original, it's not I am he, it is I am. It is ego eimi in Greek. It's like Exodus chapter 3, I am. Now, actually, the way you say I am he is ego eimi. And also the way you say I am from God is the same way. And I'm not going to give you a mini lecture on Greek about that. But there would be, to the original reader, a little bit of ambiguity because Jesus has given all these I am sayings. You know, I am the door. We haven't talked about them in the class yet, but I am the door, and I am the way, the truth, and the life. And he's also said in John chapter 8, before Abraham was, I am. And now we have another I am. You see, if somebody knocked on the door in Israel and you said, is that you, John? You would answer, if you were speaking Greek, ego eimi. Yeah, it's me. I am. It's an ordinary saying people sometimes use, but it can also be very loaded. It's the divine I am. So which one is it here? Is he just saying, hey, I'm the one, or is he saying, I'm God? Well, look what happens next and decide for yourself. When Jesus, verse 6, said, ego eimi, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. Now, which one does it sound like? It sounds like the divine I am. And then to make it clear that he's in charge, he says again, come on, as if to say, get up. You have some business here, don't you? You're not just wandering around in gardens at nighttime, are you? You know, didn't you say you had some business? Who is it that you want? Jesus of Nazareth. I told you I am he. If you're looking at me, now notice this is an imperative. If you are looking at me, then you let these men go. And they go. They leave. They escape. They could all have been arrested just as well. Jesus said, you came for me, you've got me, let them go. He's in charge. John 18 makes that very clear, that he is fulfilling his word, no one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord. He's in charge. Jesus is arrested. He is sentenced. He's executed by the Romans. But again, the initiative lies with the Jewish leaders. Spiritually speaking, we can evaluate this event in several ways. I'm going to give you a quote from John, well, not quite a quote, but borrow from John's thought, a good book called The Cross of Christ, page 58. He notices how Jesus makes use of the word hand over, or deliver over, or betray. Those three words are all one word in Greek, paradidomi. And that word is used over and over and over again. Jesus was handed over by Judas. And so forth. Three statements. Judas handed him over to the priests out of greed. Judas out of greed. The priests handed him over to Pilate out of envy. Pilate was motivated by envy. Pilate handed him over to the soldiers out of cowardice. If you don't kill him, you're no friend of Caesar. And they killed him. Yet somebody else says, I notice that this same word, hand over, deliver over, paradidomi, is also used in Romans. In Romans 4 and in Romans chapter 8, we read that God delivered up his son for us all. Therefore, a man named Octavius Winslow put it this way, and this is hyperbole, this is rhetoric, okay? He's not denying what I just said at all, but he's giving a more lofty statement. Not Judas for money, not Pilate from fear, not the Jews from envy, but the Father from love. Again, all the human perspectives are valid, but they're limited. Whatever we want to say about history and what moved people, ultimately, what moves things is God's plan, God's decree, and indeed, simultaneous with human sin and hatred, God's love. I have in your notes a summary of the events in the phases of Jesus' trial. I'm not going to simply read them over. It'd be quite boring for me to read a chart to you. I simply give it to you in case you want to teach and cover the last week at some point in your teaching, and this could be useful to you to see what is where in which gospel. I want to turn directly to the trial by the Jews. And we have to think carefully here. The goal of the Jews was, what was the goal of the Jews? Jewish authorities, what did they want? They wanted to get rid of Jesus. Somebody said it, get rid of him by sending him to Persia. What did they want to do? They wanted to kill him. But that's not easy. Why? They don't have the authority. They don't have the right to execute. Who has the right to execute? The Romans. Now, what that means is that in order to execute Jesus, because they've got to condemn him themselves and get Pilate to agree to condemn him, they've got to find him guilty of a capital offense in Jewish and Roman courts, even though he hasn't killed anybody. Even though he hasn't tried to kill anybody or committed a capital offense in either, in fact, he hasn't committed any offenses, but he certainly hasn't committed a capital offense by either set of laws. So they've got to come up with something that'll work in both Jewish and Roman courts, even though they really have nothing to go by. That's their difficulty. It's pretty substantial. And it explains the way things unfold on that night. Still in John chapter 18, there is a brief, sort of a roughshod interrogation by Annas, the former high priest, gets nowhere. Jesus says, you know, you want to know about my teaching? It's been public. Why are you questioning me now? You can listen to me anytime you want. Then he's taken to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. It's a little bit uncertain, and here again we have to think about the nature of the Bible. The Bible is not interested in giving us a court record, legal proceedings record. What it's interested in doing is telling us the story of redemption, the story of Christ, of salvation, and what it has to do with us. So it's not entirely clear as to the times or the places. Maybe just put something up on the board here. The judicial day in Rome began at 6 a.m. That's when business started. That's when Pilate receives his first business. Ordinarily speaking, the judicial day ends at 10 a.m. 10 a.m. they want to be done. The events of the day, for the sake of the Jews, they want to be done with the crucifixion in order to celebrate the Passover at the Passover meal the next day. And they also have to do it without becoming defiled. Jesus is arrested at night in Gethsemane. He goes to Annas. He goes to Caiaphas. When does the interrogation in front of Caiaphas take place? I don't really know. It might have lasted from something like, 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. Probably because the trial could not legally take place at night. It was illegal according to Jewish codes at the time. They had to wait until first daylight, right before, as close as they could to 6 in the morning. And then these proceedings here are probably informal. And then they're ratified at the end when, they get all the evidence and then they condemn Jesus. So they're operating at night. That's not right. We know, for example, that people are gathering by charcoal fires for warmth. We know that Pilate receives him early in the morning. So this is all taking place at night. And that's illegal. And how many of you have heard a study ever about the illegalities in the trial of Jesus? How many of you have heard something on that? A handful of you. At least comments about that. You have to be very careful on this. I've seen some people who make just all the illegalities. And see, you can get dangerous if you stress that too hard, because these are legal people. And they don't really want to flaunt the law. What do they want to do? They want to bend the law. They want to bend it till it hurts. They want to bend it until it does what they want it to do for them. They want to stay, as one person said, just inside the tortured boundaries of legality. They want to use the law as their weapon. And if you've ever been to law court and you had a nice lawyer on your side, that's not going to help you to understand the way the law worked back then. This is on being on the other side of the law, when all the force and all the wealth is against you. That's what we're talking about here, and manipulating the system to get you. But still, trying to stay within the system. Okay, what do they do? We can turn back over to Matthew chapter 26, verses 57 and following. What they do is try to come up with witnesses who will convict Jesus of a capital crime. Of course, they don't have one, so they instead turn to false witnesses. They bring in a parade of false witnesses. The false witnesses succeed in doing nothing but contradict each other. They get kind of close at one point when two stand up and say, verse 61, "This fellow said, 'I'm going to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" What is that from? Did Jesus ever say that? He said something close in John 2:19, the first time he cleansed the temple. Maybe the second temple cleansing reminded them of that. It's at least possible. What Jesus said there, if I can find it in my notes, it's here somewhere. What Jesus said there was, let's take a look at it, because I can't remember it. "Destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days. Thank you so much, Mike. But the temple he was speaking of was his body. Right. But even if it were true that he said he would destroy the temple and build it up in 3 days, that's not a capital crime either. And so they're not getting anywhere. They want to kill Jesus, and they're not getting anywhere. Maybe they're beginning to get weary or disturbed. And the high priest gets an idea. The high priest says, "We can't find a witness to incriminate him. Perhaps he will incriminate himself." They give him a question, maybe recalling his claims of deity, his implicit claims of deity that we've talked about before. He says, I charge you under oath. Swear solemnly, it could be translated. Tell me. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Now, we've seen before that the Jewish leaders like to try to put Jesus on the horns of a dilemma. Now, here's the dilemma. If Jesus says, no, I'm not the Christ, he's a liar. He's not going to do that. If he says yes, what's going to happen? You have to be careful here. If he says yes, that he's the Messiah, it would not necessarily lead to his death. It would lead to trouble before Rome, because if you claim to be Messiah, your claim would be a king of the Jews, and the certain expectations were that he would lead a rebellion against the Jews, so he could be charged with sedition. It's not a capital crime in Jewish courts, because many, if not most of the Jews, thought the Messiah would be a human. He's not claiming to be God, necessarily. But if he's going to be quoted, Jesus says, I want to do it my way. I want you to be clear when I say yes, because he does have to say yes if he's to answer at all. I want to say yes on my terms. And here we have to observe again very carefully the language of the Bible, which records what happened. In fact, all four Gospels have absolutely identical language, because this is so important. Again, in the original, absolutely identical. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. And our English translation here on IV says, yes, it is as you say. Literally, some of your translations have it, you said it. Or you have said it. Su ep apes. You said it. That is to say, if you ask me point blank, then I have to say yes. Let me use an analogy. If somebody asks me, are you a doctor? They ask me. I have to say yes. But if somebody says, you know, oh no, he's fainted, he fell over the balcony, he's hit his head, he's bleeding, she's gone unconscious, is there a doctor in the house? What do I say? I remain silent. Because if I said, well, I am, but it's a PhD, they'd say, no, I mean a real doctor. Is there a real doctor in the house? See, it wouldn't do any good. But if you ask me point blank, are you a doctor? Then I have to say yes. But then I quickly add, but see, what I have is a PhD. As I have an anecdote. When I was four, when my oldest daughter was four, I got my PhD. And barely four. This is about 10.5 years ago by now. And at the little party we had afterwards, my family got together. And some various relatives said, well, what do you think? Your daddy's a doctor now. She looked at me and said, no stethoscope, you know, no white coat, no thermometer. This isn't right. And then she actually said this. She said to me, I know what you are. You're a doctor of truth. It's pretty good for a four-year-old. It's the same thing that's going on here. She was trying to understand suepes. You have said it. But once he says yes, then he has to say, but not any old kind. And then he adds this, verse 64. I say to you, yes, but I say to you, in the future, or from now on, you will see the Son of Man, and now we do have a claim of deity, sitting at the right hand of the Majesty, the Mighty One, and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now that sounds like deity. That sounds like Psalm 110. It sounds like Daniel chapter 7. And in those places, the figure, the messianic figure, is equal to the Ancient of Days and seated beside the throne of God. And now the Jewish leaders tear their clothes, and we don't know, we never will know, but it's an interesting question. Were they really upset? They tore their clothes, ritual display of grief over blasphemy. But I will tell you, these were no fools. And they had to be celebrating, too. Maybe not the first instant, but they had to know, we've got him. Because he just claimed to be God. and that's blasphemy. And he just said he's the Messiah, and that's a king, and that's sedition. Jesus, from his own mouth, in telling the truth, gave them their charge of blasphemy, which they would use against him. And then they would twist it, they would manipulate it, although he was careful to say, I am the Messiah, not the kind of military Messiah you mean. I am a coming on the clouds of heaven, not a coming on the army's Messiah. But they were going to twist that statement and say, well, he says he's Messiah, he says he's Christ, he says he's a king. And that means he's a rival of Caesar. Whatever Jesus said, he was in trouble. So Jesus said what was true. And once again, we see that Jesus' life was not taken from him, but he laid it down of his own accord because he loved his friends. The Sanhedrin then convened formally and ratified their decree. As they said, we need no further witnesses. He's spoken against himself. They spat on him. They struck him. They said, if you're a prophet, why don't you prophesy who hit you? Still, we aren't quite in the story yet, except by way of sorrow for Christ. Are we in this story? Do we just simply watch and grieve, or maybe watch and get angry at what they do to Jesus? There is another figure interwoven throughout. That other figure is now mentioned in chapter 26, verse 69 through 75. Jesus in Gethsemane said a little bit earlier that he was troubled that the disciples were not able to watch with him. He warned them that they would fall away. Peter said, not me. Jesus said, yes, you. And now we find Peter, after all, denying Christ, as Jesus said he would. What should we make of it? Well, it's like all sin. It's mystifying and all too understandable simultaneously. It's mystifying that Peter, so full of resolve just a little bit earlier, Peter, who spent 3 years with Jesus, could turn on him so completely, so rapidly. Yet it's understandable how, caught off guard, following Jesus behind, showing a little courage at least, hey, you were with Jesus. Oh, no, I wasn't. Oh, no, your accent betrays you, surely. No, no. Calling down oaths on himself. He swore, I don't know the man. And then, of course, the cock crowed. And he remembered. What can we make of it? Jesus is standing in front of his questioners, denying nothing. While Peter cowers before his questioners and denies everything. So says Raymond Brown in a marvelous, thick book called The Death of the Messiah. While Jesus offers up his life for Peter, Peter won't even offer up a word for Jesus. While Jesus offers up his life for Peter, Peter does everything but curse Jesus to save his hide. He doesn't simply deny Jesus. He does it repeatedly. He does it vehemently. He does it solemnly. He does it from his position as a disciple. He does it as predicted. He does it despite his resolutions to the contrary. What does this teach us? Well, for one thing, it teaches us exactly how far human resolve can go. How far resolution can go. Søren Kierkegaard once likened the religious man to a stone skipping on a lake. Very impressive thing if you get a good smooth lake and a just right stone and have a good sidearm action. You can get that stone. It's a stone, for goodness sakes. And it hits the water and it pops 5-10 feet in the air up and 40 feet out. And if you do it just right, it'll skip again and again. You can get one Have you tried this, guys? 15 times. Little ones. 3 or 4 for sure. You can get one to go well over 100 feet. But you know what happens every time you skip a stone? Unless you've got a really narrow lake, it's gonna sink. Because stones are heavier than water. It's going to sink like the rock it is. And that's what human resolve is like. Very impressive, short run. But in the end, we are going to sink like stones if we would try on our own effort to please God. So that it tells us, you know what I'm saying here? How do we enter the story? You know what I've done to you? With whom do we identify? Sorry, it's Peter. You know the song, "Were You There When They Crucified My Lord?" What's the answer? Yes. And it's not the angels. See, we're accountable too. I suppose that just about every one of us would do what Peter did. Well, you decide if that's true or not. Nonetheless, Peter's failure is by no means all negative. In fact, there's lots of good news in it. For one thing, Jesus predicted it, and so it again shows that Jesus controls it. He also said, Satan will demand to sift you like wheat, but he also told him he'd be restored too. And that's really significant. Jesus predicts it, he controls it. Jesus also forgives it. Peter wept bitterly. We can hardly even imagine what Peter must have been going through when the rooster crowed, when he caught Jesus' eye, as one of the Gospels says. But you know what? Whatever that misery was, it wasn't the end. Peter was restored. Peter was forgiven. Peter was reinstated as an apostle, as one of the leaders of the church. And my goodness, friends, this is sad but fabulous news. If Peter can be restored for that, we can be restored for anything. We talked earlier tonight, we had a question about the continuing sin of a Christian. And it's sad and we repent and we're miserable, but God's grace and love and mercy are far greater than any evil we can do. And I will just preach for a second and say, if you're under the burden of a sin tonight, if the shame still burns, God can restore you too, just as he restored Peter. There is no difference. Whatever you may have done, and in fact, even if you are repentant, if you're even still doing it, God will forgive that as well. That's the good news. If there's hope for Peter, there is hope for all. And back to Christ again. Back to Christ again. If also we're in sorrow, there's another song. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. One, the secular version says, nobody knows my sorrow. But the spiritual version says, nobody knows like Jesus. Whatever you want to say, you endure. And a lot of us do endure a lot. Jesus endured more. Because not only did he endure it, but he endured it completely unjustly. Not too many days ago, I was accused of something of which I was innocent. Mostly. Don't you hate that? Don't you hate it when you're 90% innocent and 10% guilty? Because then you want to say you're wrong. But the truth is, well, it's so hard to say you're wrong but a little bit right. You know? And that makes the accusation sting more because, you know, it's partly true. Jesus' accusation stung, his treatment stung more because he didn't deserve it at all. And furthermore, because he bore it entirely alone. Miserable thing to bear sorrow by yourself. Jesus not only bore it by himself, but he bore it by himself when his dearest friends left him just at the hour of greatest need. Even though he told them they would, they swore they wouldn't, and they did. Jesus knows and can identify with us whatever sorrow we may have. We were there. We were there, but we're also redeemed from there too. So, Peter, then before Pilate, chapter 27, verse 11. And also we'll look at chapter 18 of John. Again, we have to say, I have to say, this is not a verbatim report. This is not a legal report. It wouldn't even make sense or be edifying then or now to have mostly a legal report. This is an investigation reported in order to illumine things for us. This is teaching us about Jesus more and about sin, particularly Pilate's sin. As I said, the Jews have to politicize. They take the statement of Jesus that he's the Messiah, their blasphemy charge, and they manipulate it so that it is now a charge of sedition. He is Christ a king, Luke 23:2. He leads our nation astray, forbidding the payment of taxes. I don't know where that came from. Yes, I do, but they twisted it. And claiming to be Christ a king. I think what they probably thought is that Pilate, if fed the right information, 6 in the morning, wanted to get through the day's business, would simply acquiesce and give his stamp of approval, sign off at once. But Pilate takes some interest. He says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Again, Jesus answers, "You have said it." He goes on to qualify that he is not that kind of a king, John chapter 18 now. He is rather a king of a spiritual army. If he was a military king, his disciples would have fought for him, he says. Pilate begins to be convinced pretty rapidly that Jesus is innocent. That the Jews are doing this out of envy, as we said before, that Jesus is guilty of nothing. But instead of taking a strong stand for his convictions, he tries to evade the issue. He tries, first, to send Jesus off to Herod Antipas because he learns that he's a Galilean. That doesn't work. Then, as if Jesus deserves to be a prisoner, he says, "Well, how about if I treat him as one of those prisoners that we let go on the Passover?" He also tries, I'm not working out of sequence here, but simply picking up some events thematically. He also tries beating him a little bit. The Romans did that sometimes. There was another Jesus named Ananias in the year 62 who also prophesied to great distress. And the Jews picked him up and beat him for a while, and that didn't work. And then they said, "Well, you Romans take care of him." And the Jews, it says in Josephus, lashed him until his bones were laid bare. And they let him go. They said he's a madman. And see, just as with Jesus, Pilate says, "Let's just beat him up a little bit, take care of things, and let him go." They lashed him and let him... No, they won't let him go. They want to kill him. But now you see, Pilate has made a deadly compromise. He knew Jesus was innocent, and yet he allowed Jesus to be beaten as if he was guilty. And he also offered the hope of releasing Barabbas as if he deserved to be a prisoner. He's compromised. And now when they say a beating isn't enough, and when they say a lashing, we don't want him released, we want Barabbas to be released, he's already in a weak position. And then the Jews pull out their trump card. Chapter 19, verse 13. They say, "You know, Pilate, if you don't release him, you're no friend of Caesar." What they mean is, Pilate will tell. And if you release someone who is guilty of sedition, and Caesar finds out, you'll pay a price. And he acquiesces and sends him off to be crucified. What do we say about that? Easy again to beat up on Pilate for his compromises, but there's something much more close at hand for us, and that is this. First, Pilate proves again that Jesus brings out what is in us. When you encounter Jesus, your soul is laid bare. And what's laid bare about Pilate? What's laid bare about Pilate is that he's a political man. His main concern is not justice, it's not righteousness or rectitude. His main concern is pretty simple: to preserve or advance his career. Preserve his power, advance things, not cause any trouble. And if an innocent man lacks power, then an innocent man will die if his career calls for it. If you encounter Jesus, it will lay bare what's in you. Your need, your turning to him, your spiritual life, or the particular form of spiritual death that is yours. So it was for Pilate, and even to this day. Let's take a break again, and we'll look at what happens next.